Welcome to The Constellations, talks across art, technology and science. Join us for encounters with experimental art projects and their makers. Welcome to The Constellations. This recording is taking place on Gadigal land in front of a live audience at 107 in Redfern, Sydney. I'm your host, Beck Dean, and in this podcast series, I talk with artists, scientists and technologists about creative collaborative projects and the ideas which bring people from different disciplines together. Today, we're joined by sculptor, sound artist and sailor, and sometimes all three at once, Dr. Nigel Hellyer.
Good evening.
And John Drummond, who is a composer, sound artist, software designer and many other things. Welcome, John.
Hello.
Now, a few months ago, I was drawn to Nigel's many social media posts about this project and its development, and I was mainly frustrated because it was happening in three botanical gardens in the Netherlands and in Germany, and because most of the links that I was seeing for the project were written in Dutch or German. So I couldn't visit these places and couldn't translate what was going on, and it all looked totally fascinating. So it's so wonderful to have you all here so that we can talk about this extraordinary project. And it's called Oratorio for a Million Souls. And Nigel, how did this project come about to work with the European bumblebee?
Well, it was quite a long haul. It was some part of European capital of culture, Leeuwarden, which is the capital of Friesland. And the project that John and I collaborated on, the Oratorio project, was part of a larger program called The Silence of the Bees. And it was funded by what they call a European interregional grant, which meant we had to collaborate with another European country, hence the two other sites in Germany.
And for a title of a project that's actually, it's a very sad title, and it's kind of hard to, like from the Australian context, it's hard to imagine, you know, a similar scale national project about the environment that was actually so grave in its kind of intent.
Well, the situation in Europe is even worse than here. There's been a drastic reduction in both bird populations and insect populations. I mean, a massive reduction.
Wow.
And it's directly related to farming practices, land clearance, and the use of agricultural chemicals. And it's the kind of visual aspect of a country like the Netherlands really belies the problem, because it's gorgeous, it's green, but what they call it in Holland is green desert.
Oh.
It's grass, 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 cows, 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 cows. And the experience of living there through spring was quite interesting, because spring arrived in 2 weeks. Suddenly everything was in flower, the fields were full of wildflowers. And 2 weeks later, the farmers had gone out and cut the whole lot. So all the blossoms that were available for newly hatched insects had disappeared. And they do that two or three times a year because they make food for cows.
Wow.
So, it is kind of a disastrous recipe. And the bee production there is virtually industrial. You buy bee nests, and they're designed for going into large-scale green, industrial-scale greenhouses.
So the bees are industrial workers.
They are slaves.
In the agricultural.
Yeah, unpaid collaborators.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this project has so many different kinds of tendrils. Can we talk about what an oratorio is in musical terms? John, maybe you can answer that question.
We are talking opera tradition, but we're talking something that's not as theatrical as opera.
So there's a choir, well, singers involved, as well as an orchestra.
Yeah, but more focused on the singing and less on the theatre of opera.
Yeah. And so in this project, you've basically built, the oratorio is actually a built environment. Can you talk us through how that what that structure actually appears like, and how you've encouraged your choir and orchestra and conductor actually to enter this space?
The oratorio really was an inversion of that space. So the oratorio becomes the beehive listening space, as opposed to a performance of human singing opera, but a million bees doing their own singing and buzzing.
Yeah, so basically you're like surrounded by the living oratorio.
Yeah, and that experience of walking into that space is both the acoustics that structure's created that you experience, and the fact that the mics that we've got aren't targeting the very big sounds of the bees. It's these little intimate interactions that they have as the bees come back and they kind of crawl all over each other, and you're hearing all these really fascinating sounds that you wouldn't actually normally hear unless you had your head inside the hive.
So basically, if I was a human walking into this environment, there would be a sound, a live sound mix happening inside these large hive-like structures.
Yeah. The idea was that you would become a citizen with the bee volk. You know? You become a bee. You're immersed in it. Yeah.
And so, John, you, am I right in assuming that you've sort of done the programming around this data that you're collecting? Can you tell us what the data that you're collecting is in the hive?
Yes, so the beehives where our bumblebees were living were actually set up as a citizen science sensor hive, and these were distributed around schools and gardens and two in each of our oratorio. And essentially they were collecting data, entry and exits of the bees, and temperature. And it was all done through a little Raspberry Pi that lived in the beehive and sent wirelessly to collect that data. And so the first thing we did, we took advantage of the fact that we had a doorbell, if you will, every time a bee left and arrived. And we also had a beautiful library of piano sounds that we'd recorded. And we just decided to have our bees play a little arpeggio every time they exited, and a descending arpeggio every time they came back in. And as you were in the space, you'd hear this kind of little piano tinkle, which indicated that a bee
was coming in or leaving.
So we have mics inside the hive, and they're capturing lots of little tiny sounds of the bees scuttling around, or if they're disturbed, they're not so tiny sounds. And so the system's doing a live mix of this. So as you walk in, you're hearing the bees enter and exit as they go out and pollinate flowers and collect pollen, and you're also hearing them scuttle and say hello to each other as they return.
And were you able to sort of, by the time that you'd sort of gone through this whole process with the bees, were you able to kind of determine what was going on in the hive relating to the kinds of sounds that you were hearing, or is it too alien in terms of the language being buzzed or spoken?
I don't know if we fully understood what was going on, but definitely listening to this thing both in our apartment where we were living with the bumblebees and then living in the oratorios as we were programming and putting it together, that soundscape revealed more and more of its intimate sounds, I think, as we tuned our ears. And then there was scurrying sounds and there were pulsing sounds. There was definitely an angry sound.
Or the seething sound.
The seething sound.
Yeah, it was quite scary. Yeah.
There's a small child in this space. Jeez.
Well, no, that's mostly us mucking around with microphones.
Lifting
in
the lid, yeah. We tried to avoid human bee interactions. But of course, I mean, the hives were, they kind of hang off the walls on the inside. They were fairly well insulated. They don't like to be disturbed by light when they're in the hive. They really go crazy if you lift the lid. But of course, you know, kids running around, tapping on things, the bees would sort of seethe if that happened.
John, you've made this kind of, I guess, this interpretation of the bees coming and going and recording their activity in the hive with microphones. But there's also another layer to this project as well in terms of the compositions that you've made. You've actually engaged with writing a composition for orchestra to play with the bees.
Yes, so not only do we have the real-time data of bees entering and exiting their home, but we collect that over the day and then over the week and over the month. And so we were asked really to create a data-driven piece of music for the local brass band. In fact, for a local brass band at each of the three oratoriums. So part of that process was, in fact, with the scientists and the musicians and the various stakeholders, the directors of the gardens, talking them through that process. So we begin with the frequency that the bee buzz makes and use that to define the pitches for the brass band and gives us a key. Working out, okay, so we've got pitch, how do we actually get some rhythmic elements from that? And so essentially treating the entry and exits were recorded as a one or a zero, and thinking about that to create a pulse. We have a series of pulses which becomes very intense at the middle of the day and sparse as they're waking up and going to sleep.
So can I talk about the, I guess, for each of you in a different way, the kind of importance of doing this work that crosses over disciplines. Nigel, you've been an interdisciplinary artist for a long time, and this work obviously is referencing a very real kind of crisis situation in ecology. Do you find that it's more urgent for us to be having discourse in this way with science?
Well, I think it is, but it's also from a personal level. It just feels like a responsibility. And I mean, sure, you can make all kinds of cultural productions, but that, for me, they often feel increasingly irrelevant. And in some ways, you can have the best of both worlds. You can still make interesting, engaging projects, but they have some social and political dimension. And whether they have a lot of effect, I don't know, but one tries.
I guess touching on that point from Nigel, it does make it really rewarding to be able to bring those dialogues about ecology, about diversification to wider audiences. So once you've actually done this, data-driven piece of music, it gets played in all sorts of different contexts and then opens up dialogues about bee ecology. Yep. And in a similar way, after spending, for me, weeks and for Nigel, months making these structures, when it first opens and when you know people actually engage with the space, and the soundscape created inside is actually quite meditative because we're capturing the really tiny sounds of the bees. And there's these just very subtle piano notes as they come and go, so you kind of hear that activity articulated. And people's responses is very, very quiet and reflective and start to open up dialogues about, well, what's happening here. And we also had a little small display visualization of the data as well. So you can start to kind of have open up discussions about the fact that a beautiful green field is in fact a desert for bees.
Yeah.
I think one of the other really positive things about that project, but also the European Capital of Culture system in general, is that the audience isn't really an art audience. It's a real general public audience. And we had, while we were physically building the structure, we had a constant stream of people coming in. I mean, admittedly, we're in a farming community, so most people are farmers. But they really understood and were really curious about the building methods and the traditional materials, things like that. And they were very, very curious about what we were doing, why we were doing it. Whereas I think, I do recall a couple of you would call them art lovers came, and their conversation was totally about themselves. And they didn't actually engage with the work at all. So I thought, hey, well, normal.
Yes. and that's a kind of, I guess that's an interesting thing with these European Capital of Culture projects, because they do something very different to, I guess, the way that we have art projects manifest in Australia, and encourage people to kind of value their cultural kind of expression. Mm-hmm. And it's not such a big thing there. Do you find that as an artist, you have more success with your practice elsewhere, or how do you feel about working in Australia at the moment?
Well, I like to work here as well, but I mean, in many ways, it's a little bit easier in Europe, and certainly there's a little, the funding is a little easier to get to, although this one was actually quite a three-year struggle to sort it out in the end. But once the funding was there, it was fine. And yeah, I think this system of capital of culture, one of the strong emphases is on legacy. Mm. I mean, they run for an entire year, and so the programs spread right out, not just in the kind of peak summer season. And there is a lot of emphasis on kind of trying to address the community in very many aspects, and that it creates a legacy that builds the city up, or the area up.
Which is very different from putting on a show and kind of parachuting in artists into places for festivals, which is what we see a lot of.
Yeah.
And it is a more costly way of doing things, but then the outcomes are actually, as you say, they're about building and about legacies rather than spectacle in the moment.
Yeah, I think there was probably a bit of spectacle thrown in as well.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us tonight. Unfortunately, we couldn't, of course, hear from the bumblebee because it's banned in Australia. But thank you, John and Nigel.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about this project and the work of our fantastic speakers, go to our website for the links, deluxe.org.au. And if you'd like to be part of the audience for our next episode of The Constellations, check out the Deluxe Facebook page. The Constellations is a podcast program on experimental art, produced by Deluxe Media Arts and Canvas, Art and Ideas on FBI Radio. This project is supported by the New South Wales Government through Create New South Wales, the City of Sydney, and 107.